Trump owns a shutdown, few takers for chief of staff, and Mueller puts more heat on the White House. It's a smocking gun edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Charges against Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort bring the investigations closer to Donald Trump than ever before.
The information that's been provided in connection with Michael Cohen and his activities really ties Trump in pretty closely with illegal activities. However, we're still not there yet in terms of the proof of illegality by Trump.
Plus, will the legislative power grab in Wisconsin backfire on the GOP?
Some people, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, probably certainly more Democrats, are thinking that it seems a bit like a sore loser kind of move, and that if the governor decides to sign these proposals, that he is signing his legacy away.
And seriously, does anyone really want to go through what John Kelly endured?
I don't know that there is anyone who walks the face of this earth who can function effectively as Donald Trump's White House chief of staff. But it has to be somebody who can tell Donald Trump what he doesn't want to hear.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And Ike to you, and Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge. Because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 256 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. You weren't sure what divided government would look like? Look no further than the testy and hostile battle in the Oval Office on Tuesday among President Trump, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, and the likely next Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. In a meeting that was originally supposed to be private, but which the president decided would be in his interest to have televised, Trump insisted that Democrats agree to pay for the border wall. He's asking for some $5 billion. If they refused, he would shut down the government over it. And yes, this is the same border wall Trump had long guaranteed that Mexico would pay for. But that was then, and this is now.
The one thing I think we can agree on is we shouldn't shut down the government over a dispute. And you want to shut it down. You keep talking about it.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No.
And then you opened it up very quickly. And
20 times.
I don't want to do what you did.
20 times, Chuck, you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wool. None of us have
you
said.
You want to know something?
You've said
okay,
it.
Okay, you want to put that
you've
on my...
You said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And I am proud, and I'll
tell
you what,
I
am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle
good
of shutting down.
That is
and
lovely.
I'm going to shut it down for border security.
But we
security
believe you shouldn't
okay
shut it down.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Throughout the meeting, the Democrats, Schumer specifically, asked for negotiations to be away from the cameras. But having it televised gave Trump the platform to make his case. Of course, most Republican leaders in Congress have long insisted that a government shutdown was not necessary. And if one were to happen, they would have blamed the Democrats. But now they couldn't, given Trump's eagerness to take responsibility for it. In all of this, Trump satisfied his base with his anti-immigrant rhetoric. And Pelosi helped her case, too, standing up to the president as she fights to win over some skeptical Democrats next month in the election for Speaker. The deadline to fund the government, by the way, is December 21st. Trump's tirade against the Democratic leaders was just one of the spats he found himself in the past few days. After Rex Tillerson, his former Secretary of State, whom Trump dismissed last March, said some things critical of the president, that he didn't like to read and he pushed policies that were illegal, Trump fired back. In a tweet, of course, Trump said Tillerson was, quote, dumb as a rock and lazy as hell. Oh, do I miss George H.W. Bush. In another personnel move, Trump said he plans to nominate Heather Nauert to succeed Nikki Haley as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Nauert had been an anchor on Fox & Friends, Trump's favorite TV show, before being named a State Department spokesperson. She may not have policy expertise, but she's reportedly a favorite of Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. She may be best known, unfortunately, for this explanation about America's strong relationship with Germany.
When you talk about Germany, we have a very strong relationship with the government of Germany. Looking back in the history books, today is the 71st anniversary of the speech that announced the Marshall Plan. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the D-Day invasion. We obviously have a very long history with the government of Germany, and we have a strong relationship with the government.
It's nice to know that the D-Day invasion is an example of our strong ties with Germany. But at least it leads to this week's trivia question. We don't know what the future holds for Heather Nauert, but who was the first U.S. ambassador to the U.N. to later run for public office? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Grab yourself a chair and sit down and get you. Gonna hear some news of the military nature. Relax while I give you the latest report. Sport. There never was a finer sight when all our boys were fixed to fight on D-Day, 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 D-Day. We hope they'll soon be coming back. For now they're on a solid track since D-Day, 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 D-Day.
We still have no idea what's going to come of the investigations into Donald Trump and his campaign's relationships with Russia, and what role he may have played in paying off women with whom he allegedly had affairs with hush money. Still, last week, we did learn a little more. Prosecutors said that Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign chair, lied about his contacts with a Russian linked to the Kremlin's intelligence services. And, according to the testimony of former Trump fixer Michael Cohen, who on Wednesday was sentenced to 3 years in prison, prosecutors say that Trump directed the effort of illegal payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, a former Playboy playmate. Cohen, quote, acted in coordination and at the direction of some unnamed person, Individual One, he's called, who quite possibly currently resides in the White House. The two separate charges are as close as prosecutors have come to linking Trump to potentially criminal conduct. But does it show that Trump conspired with Moscow to fix the election? It does not. Alex Whiting is here to tell us what it all means. He's a Harvard Law School professor where his expertise is on criminal prosecution issues. Previously, he worked at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. And before that, he was a federal prosecutor for 10 years, focusing on organized crime and corruption cases. Professor Whiting, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on.
Well, it seems to me that in laying out the cases against Manafort and Cohen, prosecutors have come closer than ever to saying Trump was behind it all, either directing criminal activity or at least personally involved. I don't remember ever the prosecutors linking Trump so closely to anything like this.
That's absolutely correct. And in particular, the information that's been provided in connection with Michael Cohen and his activities really ties Trump in pretty closely with illegal activities. And as you said, directing those illegal activities. However, we're still not there yet, because with respect to the Cohen guilty plea and his sentencing, Cohen said, and there appears to be information that corroborates this, that Trump directed the illegal payments to the two women with which he had had affairs. However, the law requires that with respect to campaign finance violations, that they be committed knowingly and willfully, which means that you have to know that you're breaking the law with that kind of a violation. We don't know yet if there's sufficient proof that Trump, in directing those payments, if he knew that he was violating the law, or whether he thought, either because Cohen told him or for some other reason, that it was lawful. So we're awfully close, but we're not quite there yet in terms of the proof of illegality by Trump.
Well, as a parenthetical, I was thinking back to the John Edwards case when he was indicted, I think, for hush money to keep his affair and love child a secret, but the indictment was about campaign finance violations and it was dismissed. Is there any similarities between the two?
Yes, there is. It is the same kind of an allegation. It's using campaign money to pay off a person to be quiet because of it would be disruptive to the campaign and harm the election prospects. So it is exactly the same kind of conduct and the same charge that could be brought against the president. So the cases are quite similar. Now, many people think that the evidence in the Trump case, the Cohen-Trump case, is stronger. However, I think that the lesson to be drawn from the Edwards case is not about the technical legality or illegality, but about a question of jury appeal. Because in the Edwards case, the case went to trial and there was sufficient evidence to go to trial, and the Justice Department saw it as a criminal violation, and the judge did too. However, the jury didn't, and Edwards was acquitted, and there was hung jury on certain counts, and the case got dismissed. And I think that's a reminder that even if the evidence does show that Trump violated the law, that the campaign finance law, that he did it knowingly and willfully, therefore meeting the elements, the requirements of a criminal violation, it's a separate question whether it's a sufficient kind of a violation for conviction or, in this case, for impeachment. So the first question is, do we have enough evidence of a crime? The second question is, if we do, is that sufficient to bring charges or to bring an impeachment proceeding?
Well, let's get away from the campaign finance violations for a second and talk about the case of ties between Trump and his people and Russia, because what I seem to get out of Manafort and Cohen is that the ties are there, and they've previously long been denied.
Yes, I think that one thing that we're seeing more and more ties and connections and approaches to Russia, approaches from Russia, ongoing relationships with Russia. Cohen was trying to get a project in Moscow, the Moscow project, going much later in the primary campaign than was previously acknowledged. And the campaign and the president have frankly lied about those contacts up until today. So what we're seeing is that the denials of those contacts and those projects in Moscow were false. So there's proof of that. Now, is there proof of a crime, of collusion? Well, in Cohen's case, there was proof that he lied to Congress about these matters. We don't know what President Trump said in his answers to Mueller and that investigation in his written answers. We don't know if he was truthful or if he lied. But so we don't know on the question of obstruction. On the question of collusion, there is a lot more smoke about relationships and that have been denied, and why were they denied. We're not yet at the point of being able to prove that there was collusion, and who knows if we'll ever get there, whether there was some kind of agreement or understanding or deal reached to influence the campaign. That we don't know yet.
Well, I don't think, I guess I don't have a true understanding of what collusion is, but if Manafort and Donald Jr. and Jared Kushner are at a meeting with someone linked to the Kremlin who says they have dirt on Hillary Clinton, is that not collusion, or am I being too layman simplistic here?
Well, as everything, it's complicated, right? So the collusion, there is no crime of collusion. The crime would be campaign finance violations. Or the other possibility is computer fraud violations. If it was found that the campaign was complicit in the Russian efforts to hack the emails of the Clinton campaign and release those. Those are the two avenues for criminal charges arising out of collusion. And that the first one, the campaign finance violations, requires some solicitation of assistance from Russian officials. Now, it's an open question if information is offered by foreign nationals, does that constitute assistance under the campaign finance statutes? those are open and complicated questions. So it's probably not enough if it's just an offer of information. However, if the information is solicited or there's an ongoing relationship or something in exchange, then you get much closer to campaign finance violations. And then on the computer fraud possibility, we know from the indictments, from the Mueller indictments, that the Russians were involved in hacking the emails of the Democratic campaign, of the Clinton campaign. If there is any complicity by the Trump campaign, either in encouraging the hacking, in coordinating it, in coordinating the releases, that would also constitute criminal activity.
That's part of the questions about Roger Stone, correct?
Correct. And we continue to hear rumblings that Stone or his associates might be indicted, and that's where there might be a connection and there might be agreement. Now, again, even if Stone is indicted for that activity, the question will be, was he acting alone? What was his relationship with the president, with the campaign? Those will be the kind of further questions that will have to be answered.
When you add all this that you've just described and laid out, and also what Mueller is preparing, you also have the fact that the Democrats are going to take over the House in less than a month, and they're promising investigations and hearings and subpoenas. Do you think that will add to Trump's legal woes, or will it be in conflict with Mueller, or does it make things more confusing?
Well, there's always a danger when you have multiple investigations that they end up conflicting with each other and disrupting each other. When I was a federal prosecutor, the one thing that we never wanted was other investigations going on at the same time that we were investigating, because it always complicates matters. So I'm sure that there will be efforts to coordinate any investigations that come out of the House with the ongoing Mueller investigation to prevent, avoid those kinds of conflicts. In terms of whether the House could supplement the work of the Mueller investigation, that's possible. And also it has the virtue of being more public, right? And the Mueller investigation has been very secret up until now. And what's unsure is how much of it will ultimately become public. If Mueller writes a report and gives it to the Justice Department, gives it to the Attorney General, or to the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, will that become public? Will that be buried? Will it go to Congress under seal? So the House investigations could start to make some of those inquiries more public, and also could create the groundwork for insisting that any report from Mueller be made public.
If I can ask you, I don't know if I can ask you, but I could try. If you took off your law professor hat and your prosecution hat and became and dealt with this political question, but I think what I'm trying to say is no one really thinks there's a remote possibility that Trump will be removed from office, given the odds against that in the Senate. Do you think all this will come to naught? I mean, Mueller makes his announcement or releases his report. The president says it's all a lie, and his supporters inside Congress and out agree with him. So what changes?
Well, I think there is a very real possibility that this all amounts to nothing in political terms, that whatever Mueller finds with respect to campaign finance violations, with respect to obstruction of justice, even perhaps with respect to collusion, it may be that his findings are attacked, it becomes political, Trump supporters are unmoved and continue to dig in. That's perhaps the least likely with respect to collusion. If Mueller were to establish clear proof of collusion, then that maybe would be a breaking point. But short of that, I think it's very possible that the findings don't change the needle, the political needle at all. I think there's also a risk of the Democrats overplaying their hand. And we've seen this before. And I think that if the Democrats in the House focus too much on this investigation and these allegations, and they don't do the business of the House and try to fix some of the nation's problems, that could end up backfiring.
Alex Whiting is a Harvard Law School professor and an expert on criminal prosecution issues. Alex, thanks so much for being on the program.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
When the truth is found to be
years, Scott Walker, a Republican, was governor of Wisconsin. Along with him was a Republican legislature. They seemed to get along fine. Then came this year's elections. The GOP kept the legislature, but Walker went down to defeat at the hands of Democrat Tony Evers.
My name is Tony Evers, and I'm going to be the next governor of the state of Wisconsin!
And with that terrifying prospect in mind, the Republican legislature decided to push through and pass laws that would weaken Evers' powers, as well as those of the newly elected Democratic Attorney General. Robin Voss, the Republican Speaker of the State Assembly, said it was all about fairness.
I think that while some on the left and many in the media have tried to make this into some kind of a cause celeb, it's a simple reality that we are ensuring by passing these bills that when we negotiate over the course of the next 4 years, we have equal seats at the table.
Rubbish, said Evers on NBC's Meet the Press. He's urging Governor Walker to veto the new laws.
The entire thing is a mess. It's a hot mess. And I believe that he should veto the entire package. In fact, at least three or four of the pieces that are in there now, he has vetoed previously. And so it makes no sense to me. And, you know, he's been a longtime public servant, and he has a legacy here. So we're hopeful that he will veto the whole thing.
Mary Spacuzza is a political reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has been following the story. Mary, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Mary, what exactly has the legislature done that would limit Evers' powers?
So there are a few different proposals that have things tucked in them. One, for example, would make it much harder for Governor-elect Evers or the new Attorney General, Josh Call, to withdraw the state from the lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. That was a campaign promise that both of those men made on the trail, saying that Wisconsin shouldn't be in that lawsuit and that they wanted to protect pre-existing conditions and other provisions in the Affordable Care Act. So Republicans want to stay in that lawsuit, and they want to be able to block the new governor from withdrawing from it. There are also some different provisions that would limit the attorney general's powers in other areas. It would make it harder for the governor to reshape our jobs creation agency, which is known as WEDIC, that was created by Governor Walker as kind of a public-private partnership. And it would make it harder. He would have to, at this point, he would be blocked from appointing a new head 4 months after he takes office. It would limit the Democrats' abilities to pick board members for that. So that sort of thing, where he's still the governor and he can still sign or veto legislation, but there would be some changes.
Okay, so the voters elected Tony Evers. They defeated Scott Walker. They're watching what the Republican legislature is doing and trying to limit the Democrats' powers. How are people reacting?
You know, I think the Republicans who control the legislature really feel like this is, outrage from Democrats and from the media. But we have certainly heard from some Republicans who aren't happy with this. They feel like it's a kind of last-minute lame duck power grab from Republicans. Even the former governor, Scott McCallum, came out against this and called on Governor Walker to veto at least some of the provisions.
Is there any doubt in your mind that had Walker been reelected, the legislature would not have passed these bills?
I would be very surprised. You know, when Governor Walker was first elected, he won the election in 2010, took office in 2011. Republicans flipped both houses at that time, so they took over the Senate and Assembly. They actually gave Governor Walker more power during that time and expanded his powers, and it's hard to imagine that if he had won re-election this time that they would be talking about limiting his powers now. I guess it's hard to predict because he didn't win, but it would be very surprising to me and a lot of people.
Is there a risk that Republicans could jeopardize their control of the legislature in 2 years?
I think that their calculation is probably that voters can often have short memories, and that that they'll be able to have 2 years to kind of tell their story in a different way. I do think that some people, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, probably certainly more Democrats, but some Republicans and some moderates, you know, are thinking that it seems a bit like a sore loser kind of move to, once you lose an election, to try to change the game.
Well, until the next election, then, is there anything the Democrats can do, anything Evers can do?
I think there are going to be some lawsuits filed over this, depending on what the governor signs. We caught up to him yesterday nearby after he spoke to a group of small businesses, and he certainly signaled that he supports some, if not much, of the legislation. He did say that he was looking very closely at line item vetoes. He has a really powerful veto pen here in Wisconsin, where you can, if there are appropriations mentioned or included in bills, you can do line item vetoes, striking, you know, specific words or sentences or graphs. He certainly sounded like he's looking at doing some of those, but I would be surprised if he, you know, turns around and vetoes the whole thing. But I do think there'll be some lawsuits. I think that there are some liberal groups, including One Wisconsin Now, that are just waiting for the ink to dry on that signature so they can file lawsuits. They won a similar lawsuit in 2016, not over the powers of the governor, but about limits to early voting, which are also included in this package. It would limit municipalities to doing early voting no more than like about 2 weeks or 13 days before an election. That would limit places like Milwaukee and Madison that have had as long as 6 weeks in this latest election. So I think there'll be a lawsuit over that. I wouldn't be surprised if the governor-elect himself sues. So I think certainly these could be tied up in the courts, maybe until the next election.
You were talking about Scott Walker's legacy. I mean, he was elected governor twice. He defeated a recall effort. He was once a leading contender for his party's presidential nomination. He has a national reputation. What do you think his legacy would be if he signs the bills?
I feel like that might be, we might have to wait and see what the history books decide. But, you know, he came into office in 2011 with sweeping changes, the Act 10 protests at the Capitol. You know, we had 100,000 protesters, actually more. We had occupation of the Capitol. The Democratic senators left for Illinois, you might remember, and to try to block the bill. So he really came in, I don't want to say guns blazing, but he came on strong. He really struggled during his presidential run. I think his run, I'm trying to remember if it lasted 71 or 72 days. I think it was shorter than Kim Kardashian's first marriage, for example. It did not go well for him. So I think on a national level, certainly the last time he was really running for office as a presidential candidate, it didn't go well for him. Then he loses this election. So I do think that his legacy could be tied up in these bills. He disputes that and thinks that he'll be remembered for all of his changes. But, you know, sometimes history remembers what you did most recently. I know some editors do, of what have you done for me lately? And I'm wondering if voters will kind of have that same approach to him. But maybe we'll have to wait and see on that. And it might depend on what he signs and what he vetoes.
You know, if I mention that Kim Kardashian quote in the promo, I'm going to get a lot more clicks. I know that.
I didn't think of that, but there you go. You're welcome.
Mary Spicuzza is a political reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
If it's a power grab in Wisconsin, it may be outright voter fraud in North Carolina. In the state's 9th congressional district, charges of absentee voter fraud have clouded the apparent election night victory of Mark Harris, a former Baptist pastor turned Republican politician, by 905 votes. The State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement has refused to certify Harris as the winner. Harris, who sought his party's Senate nomination in 2014, unseated Congressman Robert Pittenger in the May primary before besting Democrat Dan McCready last month. But it's unlikely that the House, under Democratic control for the first time in 8 years, would seat Harris. And so, with an investigation forthcoming, a new election is likely. Whether criminal charges are filed is another issue. Eli Portillo is a political reporter with the Charlotte Observer. Eli, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So help me understand, what was the problem with the election?
So in North Carolina, it's legal to help people request an absentee ballot. It's legal to help people fill out an absentee ballot. You know, campaigns can go around and say, hey, you should vote for our guy on mail in your absentee ballot. What's not legal in North Carolina is for people to go around and collect absentee ballots from voters. That's called ballot harvesting, and state law forbids that here. What's alleged to have happened here is a large, illegally run ballot harvesting operation in the eastern part of the 9th District. That's a rural area centered around Bladen County, also Robeson County, and that ballot harvesting operation is alleged to have benefited Mark Harris in the general election and possibly also in the primary, both of which he won by extremely narrow margins, less than 1,000 votes in each. So we've had voters who have provided affidavits that say they had absentee by mail ballots, and people who they didn't know came around and said they were there to collect them. These voters turned their absentee ballots over to these unknown people. Some cases they were not even filled out, they were not sealed, and after that, what happened to those ballots, we don't know.
Well, basically, what's to prevent somebody from collecting a whole bunch of absentee ballots that are unsealed and see who they're voting for, and you could throw them in the gutter, throw them in the trash if it's results they don't like, or submit them with the results they do like?
Nothing. That's why state law forbids it, you know, and you could take, in theory, you could take an unsealed ballot, and if you're working for candidate A, fill it in for candidate A. If it's already filled in for candidate B, but it's not sealed, you could just quietly throw that ballot away. And that's one of the abnormalities here. These counties that are in question have the highest rates of unreturned absentee ballots. That means that voters requested an absentee ballot, it was mailed to them, but for whatever reason, it never made it back to the Board of Elections.
And there are also people who didn't request absentee ballots but received them as well, right?
Right. So the authorities right now, they've subpoenaed the campaign of Mark Harris and also his top consultant, Red Dome Group, and they've looked for people who say that they were paid by McRae Dowless, this political operative, to harvest ballots. Some people have publicly said that, yes, they were part of that operation, that they went around and collected ballots, which, again, is illegal under state law. And they're trying to sort out, whether this could have impacted the election, and given how narrow the margins are and the unknown number of ballots that we don't know what happened to them, it looks pretty likely.
Well, you mentioned earlier Bladen County, and what I saw, they were absentee vote totals that were, like, for example, overwhelmingly for Harris and ridiculously much fewer, unbelievably fewer votes for his opponents.
Yes, and, in addition to the absentee ballot question, another issue emerged this week, and that is it appears someone in Bladen County ran the numbers for early voting before the close of the polls on Election Day. The numbers were totaled up 3 days before, which you're not supposed to do, and it appears that those numbers were viewed or leaked to someone who is not an elections judge. So the state Republican Party said yesterday that given what they've seen, they believe that this likely happened as well, so they're not challenging that. And that's a whole other issue, because if you know the early voting numbers before election day is over, campaigns have a big advantage. They would know where to focus more efforts. They would know, you know, how they're doing in early voting, and that's why these numbers aren't supposed to be run until all the polls are closed. Again, in Bladen County, they were run 3 days before the polls closed, and we don't know exactly by who.
Well, for his part, Harris says he's cooperating fully with the investigation.
If this investigation finds proof of illegal activity on either side to such a level that it could have changed the outcome of the election, then I would wholeheartedly support a new election to ensure all voters have confidence in the results.
I like, Eli, I like the fact that he said on either side. There's no suspicion that McCready, the Democrat, or Pittenger in the primary are accused of anything wrongdoing, right?
No, not in this primary, but there have been accusations in the past, going all the way back to 2010. The Bladen County and the eastern rural parts of North Carolina have kind of been hotbeds of political malfeasance accusations. There have been previous elections where people have said the absentee ballots are being messed with. And it should be pointed out in fairness that McRae Dowless has worked for Democratic candidates in the past on more local races, not for Congress, but he has worked for Democratic state house members, and he appears to be an equal opportunity political operative.
But he also, doesn't he have a felony record for fraud? I mean, isn't it somebody you just want nothing to do with in your campaign?
Well, yes, he's been convicted of, in connection with a felony fraud case and perjury in the early 1990s. So he has this felony record. And on one hand, you've got that. You might think campaigns would have nothing to do with him. But on the other hand, people I've talked to in Bladen County say this guy is, and this is the exact words they use, the guru of Bladen County. There's roughly 30,000 people there, and he knows 25,000 of them, is how one person put it. So he's got a huge family there. He's been involved in local politics in Bladen County for a very long time, especially on the local level, races, you know, like sheriff and county commission, those things that really, really can be the power centers in rural communities. So McRae Dowless has a felony record on one hand, but a reputation as the guy you need to talk to if you want votes in Bladen County that he's built for decades, on the other hand.
Harris and other Republicans are talking about the possibility of a new election. Now, you also mentioned earlier that there were complaints about what happened in the primary as well, when Harris beat Pittenger by only 828 votes. Does Pittenger get a do-over, or what's his status?
That is still up in the air. One possibility is that the State Board of Elections could order a new election, in which case it would be a rerun of the general election, Harris versus Dan McCready. On the other hand, the primary was possibly tainted, and incumbent Robert Pittenger has not said whether he would seek a do-over of that primary. Another possibility is we could have an open primary where anybody who wants could file. That might happen if the House steps in, the U.S. House, and says they want a new election. There's also a bill going through the North Carolina legislature right now that would mandate a new primary. So there are a lot of moving parts, and it's pretty unclear right now which version of a new election we would get.
When does the state, is there a deadline for the State Board of Elections to determine what's going on?
So they were going to meet by December 21st and hold a public hearing to kind of lay everything out, lay out all the evidence, and see what's next. They've been saying this week that it might take longer given the amount of documents they've subpoenaed and the speed at which those are being produced by the campaign and the consultants. So at this point, we really don't know. They have not set a date to make this determination. The House, of course, convenes January 3rd in Washington. At this point, it does not appear there's any chance Mark Harris will be certified as the race's winner and go to Washington to claim his seat at that point. After that, we could be looking at a timeline of months.
Do you have any sense of who would be favored in a new election?
Well, I've talked with political analysts who say, obviously, Dan McCready would be the favorite. He's already fundraising again. He's already, a group called Progress NC is already back up on the air with an attack ad against Mark Harris calling for a new election. So McCready's already fundraising. He's back up on the air, and he doesn't have the taint of scandal on him. On the other hand, Mark Harris has a very strong following in the evangelical community. He's very well known, and in a low turnout election where you'll probably have far, far fewer voters, and only the most motivated voters, anything could happen. So I think it's fair to say McCready would be the favorite, but too early to predict what would happen.
Eli Portillo covers politics for the Charlotte Observer. Thanks a lot, Eli.
Thank you.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last congressman forced to resign his seat over allegations of a stolen election? The answer, Richard Tonnery of Louisiana. Tonnery, a freshman Democrat, won his seat in 1976 following the retirement of longtime incumbent F. Edward Hébert. With accusations that fraudulent and illegal votes were cast on his behalf, Tonnery resigned in May of 1977. And the randomly selected winner is Fran Stevens of Denver, Colorado. Fran wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttle button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or a concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Our last contest led off with an Ogden Reed for Governor button from New York, one that read, "My President," with a picture of a young, bearded Bill Clinton, a Kiss Me, I'm for Rothman button with a pair of lips from Missouri, an anti-FDR button from 1940 that said, "Roosevelt, no, no, 1,000 times no," a button that said, "Samuels knows New York," that's for Howard Samuels, and there's another New York button that read, "Taxes and Lindsay both must go." So, when you combine Reed, my lips, and no new taxes, you kind of get...
Read my lips. No new taxes.
That was a tough one, huh? And the winner is Angela Rothman of Chicago. We'll have a new Scuttle Button puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. I have so many favorite scenes from so many Marx Brothers movies. This is one of them, in Duck Soup, where Groucho is holding a cabinet meeting.
And now, gentlemen, we've got to start looking for a new treasurer.
But you appointed one last week.
That's the one I'm looking for.
I was reminded of that scene the other day when, once again, President Trump said he's looking for a new White House chief of staff.
John Kelly will be leaving, but I don't know if I can say retiring, but he's a great guy. John Kelly will be leaving at the end of the year.
The announcement was hardly a surprise. Kelly has been reportedly on the outs with Trump and the president's family for quite some time. Stories about shouting matches and more. It is not easy being a chief of staff to a president who is his own chief of staff. Chris Whipple has written the definitive book on the history of White House chiefs of staff. It's called The Gatekeepers. And we've decided that every time Trump fires another chief of staff, Chris returns to the Political Junkie. Chris, is that fair? Do we have a deal?
I guess I'm going to be busy.
Well, that's good for us, and we'll see how good it is for the country. But let me talk about John Kelly for a little bit. When Kelly came on board, and you and I think talked about this, he was supposed to instill discipline in a president who's notoriously undisciplined. He was going to be the adult in the room, you know, someone who would limit Trump's crazy tweets. He would limit the access of Ivanka and Jared. None of that worked out.
No, it didn't. Although for a little while, Kelly had some success in in making the trains run, instilling a little bit of discipline. Speaking of Marx Brothers movies, remember the stateroom scene in A Night at the Opera where you've got a million people in a tiny stateroom?
Yeah, right.
That was the Oval Office during the first 6 months when nobody was really a gatekeeper. And so Kelly did at least impose a little discipline, but he failed in many other ways. And in a way, his failure is even worse, I think, than Reince Priebus's, in the sense that Kelly was empowered in a way Priebus never was. And he failed to do, among other things, the most important thing every chief of staff has to do, and that is to tell the president what he does not want to hear. Now, in fairness to Kelly, you know, we're not behind closed doors with him and Trump, but it's clear that that Donald Trump, A, doesn't want anybody around who will tell him hard truths, and B, that Kelly failed to do that.
When you think of it, when you think of all the things other mistakes, I think, you know, the mishandling of the Rob Porter story, he supported the family separation policy, which didn't go over well with much of the administration. But when you think of it, given all the anonymous carping about him, I'm surprised Kelly lasted as long as he has.
Yeah, and, you know, one of his great failures is that he, you know, again, people thought unrealistically that he would be the moderating influence that somehow smoothed the rough edges off of Donald Trump, and he proved to be the opposite. He reinforced all of Donald Trump's worst partisan instincts. And, you know, the day that he walked into the White House press briefing room and stepped up to the podium and launched that unhinged and false tirade against Frederica Wilson, the congresswoman, that told us a lot about John Kelly, that, you know, he was like his boss. He was willing to tell untruths without apologies. And so that's been one of his failures. You know, Trump has still not learned the difference between campaigning, which is often dividing and demonizing, and governing, which is building coalitions and getting things done. And Kelly really failed to help him in that regard.
Well, regarding the difference between campaigning and governing, his choice, the president's choice to succeed Kelly was Nick Ayers, who was a Vice President Pence's chief of staff, but he's more of a campaign operative, not somebody who's led a staff or anything like that.
That's true. And, you know, I think Nick Ayers has dodged a bullet. We don't know for certain why he turned the job down, and to do that publicly is really unprecedented. You know, by all accounts, he's a very ambitious guy, and you would think he might have leapt at the chance to have the second most powerful job in government. But that just goes to show how this job under this president may well be mission impossible. And this is a White House heading into a world of trouble, a Democratic House, Robert Mueller closing in, a tough re-election, assuming that Donald Trump is not impeached and removed from office. You'd need a wartime consigliere, as Rahm Emanuel would call it, as your White House chief of staff right now. But more than that, you really need somebody who can help Trump figure out how to govern, and he's yet to learn how.
Well, I think I asked you this question a year and a half ago when your book on the history of chiefs of staff came out, but I'm going to ask it again. How can anyone be a chief of staff to Donald Trump, who acts as his own chief of staff nearly all the time?
Well, you know, to look at the historical parallel here, there are probably no two people are more dissimilar who walk the face of this earth than Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump. But they shared the same delusion, and that was that the president can somehow run the White House by himself without empowering a White House chief of staff to help him. It took Carter 2.5 years to appoint a chief of staff. You know, Ham Jordan, who was a brilliant political strategist but a terrible chief of staff, was the de facto chief, but he didn't even want the job for those first 2.5 years. He was finally appointed. It wasn't until the final year of the Carter presidency that the right guy was put in the job. Jack Watson, who's a brilliant attorney, ex-Marine, organized. It was too late for Jimmy Carter. Time is running out on Donald Trump as well. Trump is If he wants to be Jimmy Carter, if he wants to be a one-term president, he should just keep doing exactly what he's doing.
And I think of, you have to say something to Ronald Reagan's credit, that he knew what he didn't know, and he picked somebody like a James Baker, who was a very efficient and strong and a chief of staff.
Yeah, you know, Jimmy Carter was, on paper, so much more intelligent than Ronald Reagan, right? He was a nuclear engineer. Reagan, not so much. But Ronald Reagan intuited something that Jimmy Carter really didn't figure out until the end, and that is that an outsider president needs a consummate insider like Jim Baker, Leon Panetta, Erskine Bowles, Dennis McDonough, Dick Cheney, just naming Ken Duberstein, some of the most effective chiefs in history. Reagan knew that, and he had the guy who became the gold standard, Jim Baker, who was almost the least likely choice imaginable. He had run campaigns for Reagan's opponents, including George H.W. Bush. But Reagan knew that he was the guy.
Who do you see on the list of possible successors, Mr. Kelly?
I don't know that there is anyone who walks the face of this earth who can function effectively as Donald Trump's White House chief of staff. And maybe there's somebody out there. But it has to be somebody who can walk into the Oval Office, close the door, and tell Donald Trump what he doesn't want to hear. And that's a very tall order. So it needs to be somebody who, like Baker or Panetta, is grounded, confident, comfortable in his or her skin, somebody who has nothing to prove, and who can talk to Donald Trump and tell him hard truths. So I don't know who that is.
Of all the people I saw on a possible list, I saw Chris Christie's name mentioned several times, and I think that's an interesting choice, given the fact that when he was U.S. attorney, he sent Jared Kushner's father to prison.
Yeah, and you know, he was a disaster as transition director in his very brief, I think he was transition director for maybe a couple of days before he was fired. Christie, again, he may know his way around state government, but he knows nothing about federal government. So, and I seriously doubt that Donald Trump is going to listen to Chris Christie tell him things he doesn't want to hear. So I would not recommend Chris Christie if anybody asked my opinion.
Well, in addition to the other question is, in addition to who's on the list, who may be on the list, why would anyone take the job?
Well, I'm laughing just because I was on a panel the other day on MSNBC, and somebody said, I hear you, Chris, I'm listening to what you're saying, you're the expert, but why would anybody want to be Donald Trump's chief of staff unless it's to steal the office supplies before they shut the place down? I don't know. I mean, that's his words, not mine. But it's certainly something close to Mission Impossible.
Chris Whipple has written the definitive book on the history of White House chiefs of staff. It's called The Gatekeepers. Chris, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
With a new chapter on the Trump White House, as you know, in the paperback edition. So thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That means you have to come back on the show.
Happy to come back.
Thanks, Chris.
Take care.
I'll never forget him, the leader of the pack.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
My folks are always putting him down.
Down.